Welcome to Talking to the Professors at Austin Health.
Hello, welcome to the Austin Hospitals podcast series. I'm Professor Geoffrey Zajac. I'm head of the Division of Medicine at the Austin and Professor of Medicine at the University of Melbourne. I'd like to introduce Professor Ego Seaman, who is head of the Bone and Mineral Service at the Austin and is also a professor at the University of Melbourne. Hello, Ego.
Good afternoon, Geoff.
Many people think that bones are dull, lifeless and uninteresting organs. Is that a reasonable approach?
Yes, I agree that people think that, and as a medical student, I actually thought the same. But then as I advanced in age and perhaps in wisdom, I learnt a lot more about bone, and in fact, it's a living tissue that is as active as all of the rivers and the oceans that travel through the heart, all of the lung volumes that travel in and out of the expanding and contracting lungs as we breathe. And with advancing research, what we've learnt is that the bone is an actively metabolizing organ that not only regulates itself and makes itself strong and stiff so that we can walk in the gravitational field of the earth, but it also, in fact, regulates other organ systems as well.
Why does bone need to be so metabolically active?
So the skeleton is renewing itself all of the time. For example, bridges, roads, buildings, with time, all develop cracks within them. And the same applies to bone, that with repeated use, bone develops little areas of damage, tiny little cracks, which, if they accumulate, they can result in weakening the bone, so that one day when a woman tries to lift up the grandchild or open a rather stiff window or trips and falls over onto her hip, all these tiny little cracks can weaken the bone, so the energy that is imposed when a patient falls onto the hip actually creates a crack that breaks through the bone and results in a hip fracture.
So we're all walking around with cracks in our bones?
So we're all walking around with tiny little cracks developing in our bones. But because of a machinery in bone that is called bone remodeling or bone reconstruction, the bone has this extraordinary ability to remove old damaged bone, to identify precisely where the damage is, and call in healthy bone forming cells to lay down new bone, just as a painter would come and lay down a new coat of paint onto a little crack in the wall and renew that bone so that its superb state of health that it achieved during growth and development is maintained.
So can we do anything to prevent these cracks or heal them up?
Well, they can heal themselves for a long time, but as we get older, like in many parts of the body, this cellular machinery, this repair mechanism, develops tiny little abnormalities. So that, for example, when a little crack is removed and new bone is deposited, what actually happens is that a tiny bit less of bone is put back than was removed initially when the crack was removed. This is particularly the case in women after the menopause. For reasons that we don't understand, in women after the female hormone is lost around the age of 45 to 50, the process of remodeling, of reconstruction, speeds up, and every time a piece of bone is removed, a little bit less is replaced, leaving a tiny little hole. And that's the basis of the word osteoporosis, porous bones. Little holes develop in the bone, and they are tiny, but over 20 to 30 years, they get bigger and bigger, and there are more and more of them, so that the bone now can become fragile, and when a fall occurs, a complete fracture can result.
So the commonest disease of bones is a broken bone or a fracture. So why are some people more likely to get a fracture than other people?
Okay, so some people fracture more commonly than others for a range of reasons. But the three most common reasons are, firstly, if you're unlucky and you pick the wrong mother and father, you can really just start off genetically by having somewhat thinner bones during growth and development. The second reason is if you live, like I have lived, a very mischievous youth, you can lose a lot of bone or fail to achieve the peak bone mass and peak bone structure that your genetic potential can give you during these critical years of growth and development. And we know, for example, that exercise of any time of life, exercise during growth and development, can really produce a stronger skeleton. And so that's a key period of time in life for exercise to be undertaken. Whereas in adulthood, the evidence is much weaker. And so a sedentary lifestyle, like I live and you perhaps live, working on computers all of our lives, is not the best thing. But we probably should have been very, very active when we were young and full of hope.
So if you've had people in your family who've had hip fractures or other fractures, is there some way you can assess what your risk of having a fracture is?
Right. The answer to that's yes. So we are fortunate enough to have, here at the Austin Hospital and many centres around the world, ways of measuring the bone mass and the bone structure. And these are very simple tests called a bone density test, and it gives us a certain amount of information. We also have other methods, such as we have simple blood tests that can be taken that tell us how actively the bone is renewing itself and how rapidly that bone is being lost. So when we put together the clinical information, patient's history about smoking and drinking and body weight and diseases, plus do some blood tests to tell us how active the bone is in remodeling, plus measure the patient's bone density, we can then start to build a profile of risk to try to identify those individuals who are at most at risk for sustaining a fracture, and also identify people who are at low risk, and so that these people who are at low risk are not needlessly exposed to therapy, and that we focus our therapy on those who need it most. And that's the reasoned way to approach medical care.
Now, you can have a bone density test and the bone density can be normal and you can still have a fracture.
Yes, you can, and you're asking very complex questions, and that's true. And the reason for that is not completely understood, because a bone density test is like putting on a pink set of glasses. So when we have pink glasses, we see the world as being pink, but there are many other reasons, many other structural features in bone that are not captured in the bone density measurement that can result in the bones being susceptible to breaking. But that's, a very pertinent question, Jeff, but it's a very difficult question.
So is there some way you can look at this structure?
Well, we can at the Austin Hospital. We're actually the only centre at present that we can actually look at the three-dimensional architecture of the bone. So it's not just how a chair is put together. It's the way the crossbars in the wooden, in the legs that keep the chair strong. And that's not entirely captured by the bone density measurement. But we are really on a learning curve and trying to understand what the structural basis is, the number of trabeculae, in other words, the sponge of the bone, how the plates are put together like a honeycomb that makes it elastic and able to change its length, absorbing energy, how the cortex is structured so that it can prevent the bone from bending too much, because if it bends too much, it will crack.
Now, a lot of people with osteoporosis are taking calcium tablets, and it's been suggested that this might worsen heart disease.
Okay. Oh, these are very topical and difficult questions.
I could ask you a simpler one if you...
No, whatever you want to ask. The evidence that calcium increases heart disease is based on looking at two or three studies that have been done in a retrospective way. In other words, the investigators looked through and they found some suggestion that heart attacks and strokes or angina was slightly more common. When they looked more closely at it, sure enough, this was confirmed. The problem is that no prospectively randomized studies have been done. In other words, properly conducted studies giving rigorous attention to study design have just not been done to confirm or refute that observation. The other observation that's been reported, has been that calcium may increase the risk of hip fractures. And again, this raises the worry that this may in fact be true. But again, before we start jumping from the left to the right too rapidly, we have to look at the way the information was obtained and look at it very, very critically, and at least then say, well, there's a possibility. And what that means is for future research in the study of calcium supplementation requires not only that we study the potential benefits of calcium, such as prevention of spine fractures, for example, but we also design studies that address the question of possible risks. And so, therefore, in my view, before we start making public statements and recommending everybody in the world starts taking lots and lots of calcium, it's our duty to recognize that it may do harm as well as may do benefit. And an example of that that's been shown is in hormone replacement therapy, where for many years it was believed that hormone replacement therapy was in fact the cure for heart disease, because the reasoning was that women have less heart disease than men, they have female hormone, therefore female hormone's good for you. Then they started giving hormones to men and they started to have more heart attacks. So that what's been done, proper studies have now been done in hormone replacement therapy, and there are risks and there are benefits. And the net effect of saving a few fractures is offset by the increase in breast cancer risk in women taking combined hormone replacement therapy. And the net effect of that is no net benefit whatsoever to the community. So we don't want to get into the same sort of mess that got us into with hormone replacement therapy when we're dealing with calcium supplementation or other factors as well.
So you said before that the drugs for the treatment of osteoporosis are very good. So do you think there's no room for improvement in these medications?
Yeah, I think the drugs are very good, and they're very good for two reasons. First of all, on average, they reduce the risk of having a fracture by about 50%. I think that's good. I don't think it's great. For non-vertebral fractures, where the fracture, for example, of the collarbone, the ankle, and various other bones, the drugs are not so good in that they reduce the risk by only about 20%. There are many reasons for this, and I'm not sure that we can go into all of those now. In general, however, we have drugs that reduce the risk of fracture. The other reason that I think they're good is that by and large they're safe. And we have experience with them for now from between 10 to 15 years. And overall, sure, there are some problems, but overall, these are pretty safe drugs. So they reduce the burden of disease, they are easy for patients to take, and they reduce the risk of fracture. And they restore some of the skeleton that has been lost, plus they don't eliminate the continued decay of the skeleton, but they slow it quite markedly. Is there room for improvement? Yes, there is. So there are many things here, however, that we have to learn. We generally treat patients in the same way. We have a group of drugs which stop the bone resorbing cells, the osteoclasts, or like little Pac-Men in these games, chewing away at the bone. But not everybody needs the same dose or the same type of drug. And we have a lot to learn about the specific way that we treat one individual and another individual. And unfortunately, really, research has not been done in that direction. And so it's a big area that needs more research so that we can optimize our therapy to be sure that we give it to those who need it most and avoid giving it to those who really don't need it.
So there are some newer drugs available and new drugs coming, which cause the formation of more bone rather than just stopping the resorption or the dissolving of the bone.
We have, and these drugs are called anabolic or bone building drugs, that they actually stimulate the cells that make bone. They stimulate these cells to make more of the bone and put back some of the bone that has been lost. So the trabeculae or the plates are thickened and the cortex, the outer shell of the bone, actually becomes thicker again. And these now have been shown to reduce the risk of fracture. And we still have a lot to learn because we have not found the ideal drug that does this, that completely restores the strength of the skeleton and does this in a timely fashion. We know, for example, that when we stop these bone building drugs, that instead of the benefits that have been derived being maintained, they are progressively lost again for reasons that we completely don't understand. Then it becomes necessary, after we've given this bone building drug, we have to give the blockers of the bone resorbing drugs, the drugs that stop the continued thinning. And when that's done, that does prevent the thinning. And so you have to continue therapy probably for some years.
So do you think the perfect bone-forming drug is coming along?
Well, I don't know the answer to that. I think we'll certainly continue to improve the way we give drugs, to improve the efficacy of the drugs in their mode of action, and to look very, very closely at the safety of the therapy. But whether we'll ultimately find the golden chalice and the cure for osteoporosis, I don't know yet.
Well, we might take that as a positive note. Stop there. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Talking with the Professors at Austin Health.